well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. I got to update that picture behind me. It's a little more fall-like on the 40 acres these days than what you see behind you. We got a great show today coming up on the program in just a few minutes. Mr. Robert Verbruggen is going to be with us from National Review talking about a story that he covered extensively. Steve Gutowski of the Free Beacons covered this. We've covered this at Bearing Arms as well. It's a fascinating story about an ATF regulation that isn't. And the fact that Department of Justice is now dropping criminal cases against individuals because of this regulation and because this non-regulation and because judges are starting to figure out that, oh, there's a real discrepancy here in what you're charging folks with and what these regulations actually say when it comes to firearm receivers, specifically receivers for AR-15s. We'll talk with Robert about that in just a couple of minutes. But, you know, yesterday we saw the governor of Wisconsin, Tony Evers, call a special session scheduled for next month. He wants lawmakers in Madison to take up two bills. One, a red flag firearm bill, a gun violence restraining order. And then the second measure, quote unquote, universal background checks. Now, Governor Evers has been a longtime champion of gun control. In fact, I think it was earlier this year, he actually talked about the idea of a mandatory, quote unquote, buyback for AR-15s. I reached out to one of the most passionate Second Amendment advocates that I know in the state of Wisconsin, Argo Jay, to talk about the governor's call for a special session and whether or not Jay thinks it will help reduce violence there in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Jay, it is good talking with you again, sir. How you been?
I've been well. Thank you for asking. How have you been, my friend?
I'm doing very well, and it's good talking with you once again. We've got the governor of Wisconsin who is calling for a special session on gun control, specifically red flag laws and a quote-unquote universal background check law in order to reduce gun violence. Milwaukee, you know, has seen a fair share of violent crime right now, but what do you think about the idea of what the governor is proposing to try to make Milwaukee a safer place?
Oh my God, it's just nonsense. Here we go again, right? I mean, I've reached out to the governor when he proposed to do the AR-15 buyback, and now he's talking about these universal background checks and these red flag laws. But here's the situation: the state of Wisconsin is pretty much crime-free with the exception of southeastern Wisconsin, which is pretty much Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha. And those are the cities that are closest to Chicago. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that spill-off is people from Chicago, but it doesn't matter. They're here now, so that counts for our crime rate. So yes, Milwaukee is one of the more violent cities here in America, and it has been for some years. But Wisconsin overall now is not that. So we cannot base, you know, what goes on or what needs to happen for an entire state off the statistics from just one specific portion of the state, a very small portion of the state. And on top of that, you know, it seems like he's just following suit. And I've started to lean away from being political in my commentary, but he's starting to follow suit with more of the Democratic or the anti-gun Democratic train of thought. Let's just pass these feel-good measures and look like we're doing something, and let's not really address the real problems that cause the crime.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I wrote about a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was last week, there was a story out of Milwaukee where a 20-year-old ended up, I guess there's still some question as to whether or not this was accidental or not, but it was ruled to be accidental, accidentally shot and killed his girlfriend in basically just a stupid accident. You know, they were driving down the road. He says that she picked up his gun, started fooling with it. He went to take it from her as they were driving, accidentally shot her in the head. And you know, these types of situations, that's an accidental shooting. That's not a violent crime. But, you know, these types of situations that we're seeing come out of Milwaukee, it seems to me, Jay, that one of the things that is going on here is that you've got politicians like Governor Evers, and I'm sure a lot there locally in Milwaukee, who want to make guns a taboo object. There's no desire to foster a culture of responsible gun ownership because they don't want anybody owning guns.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's just a ridiculous train of thought. We know that in society, when you have more firearms owned by more legally responsible and trained individuals, that crime lessens. So it's fact. We have data to prove it. It's not just a talking point. It's not, you know, something that we're just making up as gun yahoos, as they like to call us. It's real. More guns equal less crime. Now, along with that, though, is the fact that certain times and in certain demographics, we lack the firearms proper education. Okay. And I think that in specifically in regards to that incident is what, you know, needs to be focused on, not disarming people because people are accidentally getting killed. Let's educate them so that, you know, we can eliminate the problems before they even happen. So let's get these accidental deaths off the numbers. Let's get these accidental deaths off the books, you know, and let's start there. And let's start with actual reform, and which is starts with education, with informing people, you know. But I think a lot of that is lost because, like you said, they want to make the gun taboo. They want to make the gun the villain. And that's just not the way to go.
No, it's not. But unfortunately, that does seem to be the way that a lot of politicians are trending right now. I think they see it as politically popular to push these gun control ideas. It doesn't matter if they're effective or not. If it's about public relations instead of public safety, then they're going to go ahead and push for these laws as unenforceable or as unconstitutional as they may be. Now, you mentioned that you had talked with the governor previously. What would you like to see the governor do instead of what the governor's been doing?
Well, I didn't speak to him. I reached out to the governor.
Okay.
But I did have a meeting with, never heard back. I even made a post online asking people to call in and request that he meet with me. Never heard anything back. But I did meet with Senator Ron Johnson's office, Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin this summer. I even reached out to him and said, hey, why don't you, pull the governor's coattails? When he proposed that mandatory AR-15 buybacks, I said, this is not a good look for Wisconsin. That will set a terrible precedent in the country. And we don't, I really don't think Wisconsin wants to be, you know, have that label out there, you know. So, you know, but I didn't hear anything. And then what the senator responded back pretty much was that it's the feeling that Governor Evers is not willing to negotiate or talk to anybody who does not think like him. In regards to firearms and public safety and things like that. But that's where we stand.
You know,
I would love to see him adopt, you know, a constitutional carry here in the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those states that have adopted constitutional carry, their crime has decreased significantly. So, you know, like I said, the data is there. So, but I mean, that's a conversation for, you know, for him and Santa Claus, I guess, because that's the only thing he'll probably listen to. So,
you know, do you think that gun owners in Wisconsin, or at least gun owners that you know, are they becoming more aware? Are they cognizant of the threat to their right to keep and bear arms? Wisconsin is a pretty, at least until very recently, it's a pretty pro Second Amendment state, and yet now, thankfully, you've got pro-gun majorities in the legislature at the moment. But you certainly, I mean, I can't remember the last time there was this concerted push for gun control in your state.
I mean, I can't either. And you see, it's only coming, you know, from this particular governor.
Yeah.
And it wasn't part of the platform. It wasn't part of, you know, his campaigning. It just came out of nowhere. What I think is happening, though, I think a lot of the presidential candidates are making promises to their buddies. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If they help push the agenda, that's what I think is happening. But I mean, I'm not sure. I can't speak on that, but I can't even fathom where this is coming from or that it would be acceptable here in Wisconsin. Like, it's just hard for me to wrap my head around. And I haven't heard, because I live right outside of Milwaukee. So I'm in that southeastern district of Wisconsin. And unfortunately it's very liberal here. So a lot of I'm not hearing a lot of the pushback that I assume that the rest of the state is giving.
Well, yeah, so let me ask you about that, because one of the other things that, I think we as gun owners, I think we need to be able to talk to people who aren't gun owners. And so you talk about living in a very liberal area. Have you been able to, and again, they might not want to have these conversations with you, but have you been able to talk with any anti-gun advocates and talk about the things like, you know, criminal justice reform? You say, you know, there are a lot of folks who, and I don't get this, they believe in criminal justice reform, At the same time, they believe in putting more laws on the books. Beto O'Rourke, for instance, wants to, you know, decriminalize cannabis. I'm fine with that. But he wants to replace the war on drugs with a war on guns. And I don't understand that mentality at all. I think that they're, you know, unfortunately, I think when you argue about the constitutionality of some of these laws, there are a lot of folks who are, you know, anti-gun who say, I don't really care. I don't care if it violates your constitutional rights because I don't really think it's a right anyway. But if you can say, hey, you know what, in Brooklyn's gun court in New York, 70% of the people who are being sentenced to 3.5 years in prison are young black men without any serious violent crimes. They're being sentenced to years in prison for simply possessing a firearm. Are you on board with that? I think that provides an opening to start talking with these folks in a way that, frankly, you know, we haven't been having these types of conversations in the past.
Right. No, I hear you. And I hope that that announcement, I don't work here. So I hope that the loudspeaker announcement wasn't distracting or hope it didn't drown you out. And I couldn't hear half of what you said towards the end there. But, you know, to touch on the first point that you made, you know, living in such a liberal thinking area, you would think that I receive a lot of pushback, but I don't. I'll give you an example here. I don't know how much time we have either, but how much time do we have?
No, we're
okay.
Good.
All right. So one of my fellow teachers had an incident where two boys were drawing pictures of guns in classroom, and instead of flipping out, and this is a very liberal teacher, I don't think that he's pro gun. You know what I mean? But you know, I'm just assuming here. But I've been very passionate and very open and very vocal about what I do. Even here at work, and people now know me, you know, after a few years. So when these boys were drawing these guns, instead of him flipping out and taking it to the principal, he brought them to me and said, hey, why don't you talk to them and tell them what being a responsible gun owner is about? Like, that's what he told me. That's what he asked me to do with these two young black boys. You know, and I was floored, you know, because it gave me an opportunity to try to educate them. And I did. And they came out of it a little bit differently, but, you know, and then they start to ask questions. Well, can you teach me? And I said, well, sorry, son, I can't teach you. That's a job that your parents have to do. And then my heart broke because then I'm thinking, well, are their parents equipped? Do they have the skills? Which just goes to show why we need firearm safety education, conflict resolution, the whole thing, like my buddy Mars does with Black Guns Matter, the whole thing that Kevin Dixie does with No Other Choice, I mean, with Aiming for the Truth. You know, let's address the problems around the ignorance and around guns, and then guns aren't the problem, because then we'll remove the thought that guns are problem solvers, okay? And now we'll put in their responsible thought and how to be a responsible citizen. And, you know, knowing that we have the right to defend ourselves and protect our lives is different than having a problem solver on you. So.
Absolutely. Man, I got to say, I really wish that the governor would have responded to you, because I think that he could learn a lot if he would sit down with you for a few minutes. But I appreciate you joining us today, and we'll let you get back to work. But it's great talking to you, and we'll be doing this again very soon.
Well, definitely, man. I definitely want to touch base with you. I know you're going to D.C., right?
I am. Are you going to be there?
Oh, I definitely will be there. I need to get some video of you with you talking on some different things too, man. You can't be the only interviewer all the time.
All right. Well, we'll do that then in less than 2 weeks. We'll see you in D.C.
I'll see you in D.C., brother.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Argo Jay joining us here on Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I got to tell you, I am so excited about the Second Amendment rally. As a matter of fact, I have a little announcement of my own to make. Not only will I be speaking at the Second Amendment rally on November the 2nd in Washington, D.C., on the grounds of the U.S. Capitol, but right now, the one and only Miss E, my lovely bride, is actually planning on attending that rally with me. I got to tell you, it's tough to get my lovely bride off of the farm. It is even more difficult to get her to go to Washington, D.C., inside Washington, D.C. Northern Virginia is bad enough with the traffic, but to get her to go inside Washington, D.C., that's remarkable. But she said, you know what? If there are folks that are going to be standing up for their Second Amendment rights, I want to be there. And I hope that you will be there as well. You can find out more information at Second Amendment Rally. That's 2ND, SecondAmendmentRally.com. And hopefully we will see you there on November the 2nd. Again, if you are planning on attending, I've heard from several of you. Let me know. Drop me an email, cam.edwards@bearingarms.com. You can tweet at me on Twitter, @CamEdwards. But let me know if you're coming. We are planning on sticking around and doing something afterwards, going and grabbing a drink or grabbing a bite to eat. But anybody who wants to hang out and have some fun and sit and talk, we will be there. And we would look forward to you sharing a table with us. All right. Now, earlier today, I had the opportunity to spend some time with a friend, Robert Verbruggen from National Review, who wrote a fantastic piece about it's a complicated story. But the bottom line is there is an ATF regulation that has been enforced that, as it turns out, is not an actual regulation at all. And this is causing some big problems, not only for ATF, but for the Department of Justice in prosecuting some criminal cases. Take a look and a listen. Robert, thanks so much for joining us on the program. It is great talking with you today.
Good to be here.
And this is such a fascinating story. I wrote about this at Bearing Arms. I'm glad you've covered this as well. It's kind of bizarre in a way. I mean, you've got the Department of Justice that is, in essence, dismissing charges against individuals because they're worried about the precedent that might be set if, in fact, these cases are pursued. And it all involves an ATF regulation. As you say, the ATF is basically trying to enforce a rule that doesn't exist. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, basically what happens is that under federal law, you know, obviously there are a lot of rules that you have to follow when you're selling a gun or buying a gun or you're manufacturing guns. And the way the federal law handles this is to basically say that the receiver of the gun, sort of the frame that holds the guts of the gun, is the important part. So you can buy and sell, you know, springs for guns or other parts for the gun without following all these regulations. But the receiver of the gun is very important. But it doesn't define that term. It doesn't tell you what counts as a receiver and what doesn't. So under the Code of Federal Regulations, basically the regulations that the federal, you know, the executive branch has gone through the formal rulemaking process for, it specifically spells out what you need to have a receiver. And and I have the language right in front of me now, and it defines a receiver as that part of a firearm that provides housing for the hammer, bolter, breech lock, and firing mechanism, which is usually threaded at the forward position to receive the barrel. And the problem is that not all guns have all of those three things in a single piece. The AR-15, for example, has what's called a split receiver. It has an upper receiver and a lower receiver. So it doesn't actually fit the regulation, and they're sort of just discovering this now after decades of basically just ad hoc enforcing a rule in which the lower receiver is considered the firearm and it's regulated. And they've never gone through the formal rulemaking process of changing the rule. They've just been enforcing the rule. So in this case out of California, you basically have this guy who did this. I mean, it's kind of a crazy story. He had all these different ways that he was trying to avoid the law to basically intentionally sell guns to bad people. And the judge found against him, and you know, he did break the law.
Mm-hmm.
But in going through the charges against the guy, the judge looks through, you know, the arguments that the lawyer made, looks through the actual language of the law and the language of the regulation and says, you know, wait a minute. He didn't break the law against, you know, selling a firearm, you know, selling a receiver because the parts that he sold were not defined as receivers. So basically, if you have if you sell an AR-15 in multiple parts, if you sell an upper receiver or a lower receiver separately, that is not covered under the literal language of the regulation that's currently on the book.
Okay, and when the judge made that determination, DOJ responded by what? Basically tossing those charges out because they were concerned about the precedent that might be set if this judge's ruling actually stood, right?
Right. It's sort of this weird tentative ruling that the judge put out to sort of give them some time to adjust. And basically what the government did was say, you know, this isn't good. You know, the judge did find against the guy, and we can pursue this and have those charges stand against him. But if we do that, this ruling is going to become final. So what they did is they basically just dropped all the charges. He technically speaking, got some sort of slap on the wrist. I think he has to stay out of trouble for a year,
right,
or something to avoid prison. But he basically got let off with a slap on the wrist despite illegally manufacturing guns and selling them to criminals.
And
it's a very interesting case.
Well, it is. And despite the fact that the judge's ruling in this case is not final, obviously the logic that the judge used could be used by other judges, and And I'm certain that within legal circles, particularly, you know, when cases like this come up, attorneys are now going to be able to point to this this flaw in the federal regulations and say, look, you're charging my client with something that is not an actual violation of the law. So what's the fix here, Robert?
What I suspect the government is going to do is just pray that, other judges are going to see this differently and are going to let them get away with it. They can, this is a regulation. As I said, the actual statute just says receiver and doesn't define it. The definition is found in the regulation. So you don't need Congress to act to change it. They could change the regulation. But the problem, I think, is that, you know, once you change the regulation, you're admitting that the regulation is bad. Mm-hmm. And so all of these cases where, you know, previously people have been convicted or there are pending cases, you're going to put a lot of that stuff in jeopardy. So I think that my guess is that the immediate term approach from the government is just going to be to pray that other judges see this differently.
Isn't that amazing?
But I think they were really hoping that this wouldn't draw a lot of publicity. but it was CNN that found out about it and wrote a very long and detailed piece about it. So now everybody knows that there's this problem with the regulation.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess the good news for DOJ was it's CNN and not Fox. So it's the third rated cable news network. But, you know, people like yourself and myself and Steve Gutowski. And I think this has become pretty common knowledge now, at least in the gun world over the past week or so, thanks to your work and the work of others. And again, I mean, it's just so mind-boggling to me that you've got, you know, a federal agency that says, well, okay, we're not going to do anything because if we do anything to try to make it better going forward, it could mean really bad things for those cases that have already been decided, or those cases that are currently in the pipeline. We hear a lot about, you know, quote unquote common sense gun safety regulations. Apparently, there's no common sense here at all.
What's amazing to me is that this goes back to the 1970s. There are ATF documents dating back decades, you know, expressing confusion about how to apply the law to split receivers, where you don't have a single part of the gun that meets the definition in the statute. And instead of going through the formal rulemaking process of doing it right and writing the definition into the regulations, they just sort of came up with their own classification in-house. So if you're a gun manufacturer and you go to the ATF, they will tell you, you know, this is what you have to do under the way that we regulate it. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't actually written in the regulations. So if somebody, you know, does that on their own without asking permission, there's nothing that you can point to say that, you know, you are on notice that this was illegal. This is in our official rule book here. They can't do that because they never bothered to write it there.
Unbelievable. Robert Verbruggen with National Review. Again, I appreciate you covering this story. And you know, how big an issue do you think this is going forward? You know, as you say, it seems like ATF's going to hope that other judges around the country just sort of ignore what this judge in California found. But how many cases, you know, roughly, do you have any idea how many cases we might be talking about in any given year?
Well, there was actually a request put in, I think, one of the litigants in the case suggested picking up that number, but I haven't been able to find that they actually put the number together and went through their the pending cases that they would have access to.
Well, I imagine that's probably not something they'd like to publicize either, if it's a fairly significant number, right?
Yeah, they don't want you to know. But I mean, I think that this is going to be a fairly short-term issue because if courts do start finding the same way that this judge did, I think they're just going to rewrite the regulation and it's going to basically mess up a lot of current prosecutions, but it's not going to be that, you know, going forward, you know, forevermore, you're going to be able to buy AR-15s and parts without going through a background check.
Yeah.
But to me, it's an example of just how, you know, first of all, how difficult it is to write gun laws in a way that you can't evade.
Mm-hmm.
And also just how, I mean, because it's, you know, it was, you can make an excuse for them in the 1970s when they're first figuring this out, but how do we get 50 years later and still have this problem on the book that's never been addressed?
Government inertia is a pretty powerful force, right? And once something is on the books, you just kind of sort of keep it there and you keep going along again until somebody, you know, raises those red flags. And it sounds like that actually is what happened for decades. And again, I mean, as you say, if this is a short-term fix or a short-term problem, if they do go around and try to fix this, what does that actually mean for all of those cases that have been prosecuted since the 1970s? If the government acknowledges, yeah, okay, we were wrong here and we didn't really have a good definition, what about all those people who were prosecuted and even convicted in the past?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a rough issue. It's going to be something that courts are going to have to go in and decide, you know, are convictions going to be expunged after the fact? You know, are there, I mean, those are all really complicated areas of the law that I'll confess I don't know all that well.
Yeah.
But, it's just a real mess now because you have, you know, if it turns out, if other judges are willing to find the same thing that this judge said, and this is the wrong interpretation of the law, and they've been enforcing this for decades, that's a lot of past cases that now come under scrutiny.
Oh, absolutely right. Robert Verbruggen, again, with National Review. Appreciate you spending some time with us, sir. Thank you so much, and look forward to doing this again soon.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, let's get to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, we'll call this a matter of time. And by the way, I'll be reaching out, I think, I'm going to be using A Matter of Time and the Recidivism Report interchangeably. So that means two bottles of hot sauce going to be going out to the individuals who suggested those titles. I'll be reaching out via email, and we actually need to get the hot sauce bottled. But as soon as it's ready to go, it's going to be in the mail to you. All right. Today's Recidivism Report, or A Matter of Time, from North Dakota, of all places, where the suspect in a shooting back in February in Mandan, North Dakota, ended up with 2 years probation. Yeah, 36-year-old Terrence Soriano is accused of shooting a guy and assaulting his ex back on Valentine's Day of this year. He had apparently gone to his ex's home. There was a custody swap involving their daughter. He got upset, Soriano did, argued with his ex about the new relationship she was in, and allegedly shot the new boyfriend and assaulted his ex. So how did he get 2 years probation? Well, prosecutors say that the guy who was shot has left the state. They can't find him. There's no evidence that he'd be willing to testify. There were other witnesses, perhaps, who could have testified, but it sounds like that would have been a struggle for prosecutors. So they went with what they thought was the best deal that they could get and allowed Soriano to plead guilty to 5 misdemeanors and avoid any more jail time. He served about 180 days in jail awaiting trial. So he was credited for that time served, and then the judge placed him on 2 years probation. Mm-hmm. Probation. That's it. 2 years. Now, again, not all of these cases that we cover every day involve judges that are just given slaps on the wrist to repeat violent offenders. Prosecutors, they do have a very difficult job. And if you don't have individuals who are willing to come forward and testify about what happened, you may not have much of a case at all. And it sounds like prosecutors really felt like their case was damaged by the lack of cooperating witnesses. And so they had to go with the best deal that they could. It is just, to me, still, it's disappointing to see this outcome where an individual could have gone to prison for years for a violent crime and instead slap on the wrist and sent on their merry way. All right, our armed citizen story today from Fostoria, Ohio. And there's still a lot of details unknown in this case, but it went down over the weekend. There was a home invasion in Fostoria. 911 call came in just after 11:30 on Saturday night. When police arrived, they found the homeowner with a gunshot wound. They also found another individual, a masked individual, who was dead from a gunshot wound. WTOL in Toledo, Ohio says, according to the police report, two men broke into this home, got into a physical struggle with the homeowner. Police Chief Keith Loreno says, because the investigation is ongoing, they're not releasing who or how many people actually fired a gun. Second suspect took off before police arrived. No vehicle description available. The deceased suspect, at last report, not able to be identified through Fostoria's police records. So they're now working with the Ohio Bureau of Investigation to figure out who this individual was and hopefully find a suspect. The homeowner who was shot sounds like is going to recover. And again, there are a lot of details that we still don't know about this case. So we will continue following this story out of Fostoria, Ohio. And if there is more to bring you, we certainly will. All right, now on to our good deed of the day from Michigan, where a conservation officer has now saved a life for the fourth time. Jeff Ginn works for the Department of Natural Resources, and he just has a knack, I guess, for being in the right place at the right time and willing and able to do the right thing. The Michigan Patch covered Officer Ginn's actions. He is being hailed as a hero. He helped resuscitate a man in a motel Last year, he got a Department of Natural Resources Life-Saving Award, and that is the fourth award that he has received in his career as a DNR employee. This was almost a year ago, November 13th. Ginn responded to a medical emergency involving a 75-year-old man who was reported unresponsive at Kronk's Oak Ridge Motel in Newaygo. Within 4 minutes of receiving the call, according to authorities, Ginn arrived at the scene, evaluated the man. He did not have a pulse. He was not breathing. He ended up using a defibrillator to help get that heart started once again. He ended up performing chest compressions until paramedics arrived. Paramedics provided care for the victim. Ginn continued chest compressions. They ended up taking the individual to the hospital. He regained his pulse. A day after the incident, the man was conscious with full neurological function. It's pretty amazing. Jason Best, who's field supervisor at Life EMS there in Newaygo County, says Jeff's help gave this patient a fighting chance of survival. He said it is very nice to have this compassion and helpfulness in a rural county where help is limited. So Jeff Ginn, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. We thank you, sir, for your good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Thank you again for being a part of the program today. You can subscribe to the podcast at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, townhall.com's podcast page. You can also subscribe to Town Hall Media on YouTube, and that way you never miss a show. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. But in the meantime, thanks again for being a part of the program. Thanks for watching, listening, and spreading the word. And we'll see you here soon with a brand new Bearing Arms, Cam and Company.